This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
There is optimism, and then there's the facts. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. We have a triple header for you this week. The Watchman is going to rattle out danger with a brainwave escape hatch as I interview California author Rebecca Costa. Transportation planner Jeff Tumlin gives a short, stark warning about how cars make us fat, sick, and dead. Good commuting fare for all the folks. And we'll wrap up with some happy news from the inner doomster, NASA's project to black out your city before the next solar storm begins the long emergency. Could it be the knockout blow we've all been hoping for? I don't mind if the future is scared and miserable. I just want my toilet to keep on working, and now the sun wants to screw with my plumbing. Do you think I'm crazy? Keep listening.
Radio EcoShock. To all this, the turmoil of the past 6 months, and the fact that no one seems to know what happens now, and we have a bleak picture indeed.
One town soaked with 20 inches of rain in the last 48 hours. That area has been declared a disaster zone.
He said the bitterest truth is that we can't prevent global warming. The challenge is only how to keep it from getting worse.
Many of us feel civilization could be approaching collapse. We face problems so big we may not be able to solve them in time. Rebecca Costa searched for the demise of past cultures, picking up some clues. She sees a possible way out for our own times. Her new book is The Watchman's Rattle, Thinking Our Way Out of Extinction. I'm Alex Smith. Rebecca Costa, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about your life journey. What led you into this book?
Well, I began in 1975 with E.O. Wilson's publishing of Sociobiology, The New Synthesis. I began as a sociobiologist. But as soon as I graduated college, much like many undergraduates, I had to go find a job, and I happened to land near Silicon Valley. So I would say high-tech hijacked my burgeoning sociobiology career. But I found myself in the middle of really exponentially accelerating complexity. In Silicon Valley, we were introducing new technologies at first every 6-8 months, but then pretty much by the week, new advances were coming out. I was fortunate to develop my own company, sell it, and move away. And after stepping away for 5 and 6 years, it really became clear to me that complexity was advancing at a rate that was just not sustainable by the human brain. As you know, evolution takes many, many millions of years, so therefore the brain requires millions of years to develop new facilities, and yet the complexity in terms of just making new discoveries, finding new factual information, new technologies, was advancing at such a rate that it just simply wasn't sustainable by the biology that we've evolved to this point.
Well, I got a quickie question for you. What is the Watchman's Rattle?
That's a great question. The Watchman's Rattle, the reason that the book was named The Watchman's Rattle comes from earlier times when the first police force, rather than carrying weapons, they carried these large wooden rattles that made an alarm in the middle of the night to let citizens that were sleeping know that there was some danger. And the citizens would wake up from their sleep and come and help the watchman. So it was basically a summons for help.
And in our own times, we have the economy looking pretty fragile. We've got climate change. We've got possibly peak oil and overpopulation. It goes on. It's a long list. Are we too worried about collapse? Is it a real possibility?
Well, as you know, in my book, I am less interested in the specific cause of the collapse. I see the causes of collapse as being simply lots of planes stacking up in the air, all trying to land on the same runway. Eventually, if you get enough planes in the air, one of them is going to cause a catastrophe. So the real key is, well, what caused all the planes to begin stacking up? And so I'm interested in the conditions that lead up to the eventual cataclysmic event, whether that's the Mayan drought or the fall of the Roman army. It really doesn't matter to me which event gets you. The important question to ask is what caused that event to eventually become so powerful that it could not be stopped.
Let's backtrack, if we can, to Roberto Vacca's 1973 book, The Coming Dark Ages. He argued that overcomplexity would cause civilization to crash, but he didn't know the computers would help us control our world, and of course the collapse did not occur then. So you come from a Silicon Valley high-tech experience. Do you no longer think computers can help us manage complexity?
Well, I have a love-hate relationship with computers. I don't know how I'd get through a day without them as a science writer. But on the other hand, simply even going on the Internet to find information is overwhelming these days. I think the example that I give in my book is that I went to investigate the different terrorist groups that have cited the United States as an enemy so that I could be more educated in the positions that the United States took on national security, and there were 134 of them. I don't see how computers help me get through 134 traditions, agendas, and history of 134 terrorist groups. I just don't see how computers can narrow that down for me.
So we may not be able to make sense of it even at the top, no matter what the computers are doing. Well, I sense a new powerlessness of most authority, perhaps even the federal government in the United States, but in a lot of authority, and in our own lives, we feel like we can't do much about anything. Do you feel that?
I feel that we've reached a cognitive threshold, which earlier civilizations have also reached, where we are succumbing to complexity, and computers to some extent exacerbate that complexity by generating so much information that we can't really get to the facts. And when you can't get to the facts, you then cannot make rational decisions, including in public policy. So the helplessness that we feel is simply succumbing to the complexity of our circumstances. Let me give you an example. Right now in the midterm elections, there absolutely comes as no surprise there are more people not turning out to vote than are voting. My explanation for that is I frankly cannot make head or tails out of the ballot initiatives. They're very complex. There's too many of them, and I refuse to make important decisions based on 30-second commercials and lawn signs. So when you're in that situation, you become a bit gridlocked, and you reach some impasse that you can't get over because you can't get to the facts to make a responsible decision. Even in that circumstance, democracy begins to fall away to zealots who are okay making decisions off of lawn signs. And this is hugely problematic.
And you've given an example on a simpler level of just trying to figure out what kind of milk to buy.
Exactly. I mean, I went to the store and there's, 20-some-odd types of milk to buy. There's, 1%, 2%. One of the problems I have is I don't know if 2% is 100% worse than 1%. And then there's non-fat, there's acidophilus, there's goat's milk. There's soy milk, which really isn't milk, it's soy juice. I really don't know what kind of milk to buy. I don't know what type of toothpaste is the best for me. I'm overrun with decisions that I have to make on a day-in, day-out basis, and increasingly I'm making them based on very little data and only on my intuition and beliefs, or maybe hearsay from a friend of mine.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Rebecca Costa, author of the new book, The Watchman's Rattle. Get more from her website, RebeccaDCosta.com. Rebecca, one of my listeners heard you in that panel discussion at the Harvard Coop with famed sociobiologist E.O. Wilson. You proposed a new cognitive strategy or even power that might save us after all. Please tell us about that.
Well, neuroscientists are making a very shocking discovery that there's a third form of problem solving that is ideally matched to highly complex problems. And we're at the point now where about 300 milliseconds before you're going to evoke this form of problem solving called insight, we can identify a part of the brain called the ASTG that lights up beforehand. And it's really an important discovery because if you think about it, over millions of years, we've been evolving left and right brain problem solving to a point where it's very comfortable and it's very natural and it's very automatic for human beings. But when you have multi-layered, highly dynamic and chaotic problems, the left and right brain problem solving that we've evolved to this point isn't really much help, and that's where we've come increasingly to rely on computers to give us as many scenarios as we can so that we can fit that into left and right brain problem solving that we've evolved to this point. Insight is kind of a shortcut in a chaotic situation. It's what neuroscientists call an aha moment, where suddenly out of nowhere we make a connection between data that we have in our brains that we've never made before, and we just kind of shortcut through all the things that are irrelevant to the problem.
It seems, though, like our institutions from our schools, which have cut out the play breaks through the corporations, are working three jobs, and then you get mass media at night to fill your head. When do we have time for insight?
Well, we're not at a point where we can generate insight on demand. In fact, one of the things that people that show up at some of the talks that I give, they complain that I don't tell enough about insight. And in fact, we've only discovered insight in the last 4 and 5 years, and we're trying to learn about more of the things that will induce insight. We do know that there are some things that help the human cognition from a biological standpoint. For example, we know walking. Walking helps to increase blood flow to the brain. But also, when you think about it, a third of our brain developed over the course of 4 and 5 million years when we became bipedal. So there's still an association between walking and the amount of cognitive resources you have to use to just stay upright and be able to walk on uneven surfaces like cobblestones, and the amount of exercise that the brain gets. And so it's not illogical from a strictly biological standpoint to understand you give your brain a great workout when you just simply walk on uneven surfaces.
And your book also suggests that even in companies, people should have work breaks. They should just take some time out because they'll get some better work done afterwards. Is that right?
They will. Actually, a number of Silicon Valley companies have instituted what are called standing desks. And what they are, they're desks that are about chest high that you can put your computer and everything on. And underneath it is a slow-moving treadmill where you are actually walking while you're working. And people, there are so many benefits to that. I mean, we're so used to sitting and becoming a very sedentary society that just simply moving your feet while you're making critical decisions seems to have a great benefit from a cognitive standpoint.
Although I got to say, that sounds a little scary, too.
Well, since we all like to sit and not move, you know, a lot of people say, gee, I can't even imagine walking while I'm having to, you know, use my computer. And it takes a little getting used to, but I have to tell you that it's showing some remarkable benefits. Even in schools, they put children, instead of on chairs, on large balls so that while they're sitting at their desk, they can be moving around and the brain is having to calculate how they balance on those balls. And that actually shows a lot of cognitive benefits as well. So sitting is not our ally.
As you mentioned, in these recent midterm elections in the U.S., we didn't see a mass outbreak of insight by any means. Do we have to hope, perhaps, that a minority with greater insight manages to overcome the problems of a still superstitious, I would say, population?
Well, I don't know if you want to get me started on the midterm elections, because from my standpoint, all we see is the oppositional behavior that I describe in my book under the chapter Irrational Opposition. As the facts become increasingly difficult to gather, most civilizations begin turning to beliefs, and this is what leads to irrational public policy and eventually the demise of the civilization. We seem to be tracking that in that same way. Most of the candidates that were running for election simply opposed the other candidates' ideas and any position that they were going to take, and they offered almost no solutions. And we've become a society that has really confused opposition with advocacy, and this is a really dangerous road to take.
I wanted to ask you, Rebecca Costa, how you know E.O. Wilson, and why do you think he is embracing your new book, The Watchman's Rattle?
I know Dr. Wilson from 1975 when I was an undergraduate at UC Santa Barbara, and he came out with his book, Sociobiology, The New Synthesis. I was able to make his acquaintance a few years ago as I was starting the research for The Watchman's Rattle. I believe that Dr. Wilson feels that we will not be able to solve our most dangerous problems unless we get past the groupishness that we inherited from our prehistoric ancestors. We are a organism that likes to form groups around particular ideologies and then battle and take over or annihilate other groups that have different ideologies. And this goes way back to our prehistoric ancestors. And we have the vestiges of those instincts right now, and they are not serving modern man in a constructive way.
And I'm also very worried about climate change. I think it's one of the big challenges that faces us. Are there things in this book that I can apply toward solving that problem?
Absolutely. One of the things I talk about when we hit a cognitive threshold and we become unable to solve our most complex problems that we can mitigate in a way that accepts high failure rates. And I use the example of venture capitalists, for example. Venture capitalists are experts at failure, not success. For every 100 companies they invest in, they expect 80 to fail or not do well and 20% to lick the problem and become a highly successful and profitable on Wall Street. So in a climate where you can't pick the winning solutions from the losing solutions, and climate change is a great example because we can't even agree on whether climate change is occurring or not, the only way that you can attack a problem which exceeds our cognitive abilities is to attack it on multiple fronts with an expectation that some of the things that you attempt to do are not going to work, but the ones that you do select that are effective will mitigate the problem effectively enough that it will buy you time to get to a longer-term solution. So you really have to attack it on all fronts.
I think some people have spoken about that when they talk about wedges, the different things that need to be handled each separately that could add up to a solution. I wanted to say, too, are you starting or hoping for a new movement? And if so, what might that look like?
Well, if there is a new movement, I think it's an old movement. I think we have to at some point acknowledge that we are biological organisms all trapped in the same evolutionary spacesuit, and it can only acquire new features in million-year increments. Therefore, over a long period of time, our brains begin to fall behind the complexity that humans are able to generate. And in a circumstance like that, we need to mitigate using high failure rate models, and we also need to consider doing more things to arm the brain against encroaching complexity so that we can have rational decisions and rational facts return to public policy.
I admit I'm a little dubious we're going to think our way out of this mess. Why should we believe you?
Well, I don't know that anyone should believe anyone. I think you have to go and get the facts. Again, it doesn't solve anything to just believe what somebody says or to follow a unproven belief of any type, including what I've written in this book. I have to tell you, I'm much more comfortable if people examine the facts I present in the book and then go and acquire facts of their own. Each of us is responsible for accepting a hypothesis to a certain point and then going and verifying that and making sure that that is correct and it's appropriate before we adopt any further beliefs.
Rebecca, as we wrap up, is there something I've missed? Is there a message you'd like to leave with our listeners?
I think if I were leaving a message, it would be to get off the couch. There is something that you can do. It is not gloom and doom. We have lots of time to change the course, but we must change the course based on rational thinking, facts, and not succumb to the complexity that is making it difficult to acquire those facts.
You have been listening to Rebecca Costa, the California sociobiologist and successful businesswoman who took some years off to find out why civilizations collapse. It's all in her new book, The Watchman's Rattle, Thinking Our Way Out of Extinction. Find out more at RebeccaDCosta.com and notice that Rebecca has two C's in it and the middle initial D is in that web address, RebeccaDCosta.com. Rebecca, I know you still have a whirlwind of media appearances ahead of you. Thank you for taking the time to join us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith. Download this interview as a free MP3 from our website, ecoshock.org. Last year, I got some great recordings at the Resilient Cities Conference in Vancouver, Canada. You heard people like Richard Register and Sam Adams, the mayor of Green Portland. This year, the Gaining Ground organizers were attuned to the troubles, calling it Healing Cities. I'm going to play you one of the best short speeches from that session. Jeff Tumlin is an award-winning transportation designer, Stanford grad, and as you'll hear, a fearless speaker about everything we don't want to hear. Find out how many cars it takes to make us fat, stupid, and dead. The introduction is by Rob Abbott, founder and CEO of Abbott Strategies.
Every now and then you get a chance to meet someone in a collegiate profession, and it just kind of leaves you going, wow. Jeff did that to me a while back. We were a few years ago, we first met, you got to love this, we first met in the desert on the other side of the world in Abu Dhabi. We were planning a region for His Royal Highness, the Sheikh Khalifa, I believe it was, for an area of the world that has 10% of the operating and known oil reserves on the planet. Now, you'd think that a transportation planner and engineer working next to 10% of the world's oil reserves, that'd be sacred ground. But for Jeff, he brought an entirely different approach to this. He started challenging that entire country to rethink how they move around. And that's one thing for us to say here on the temperate climates. But when you are in the desert in September at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, it sits at around 50 degrees outside at about 100% humidity and blowing sand. And when you want to get people out of their cars to go walk somewhere, that is a formidable challenge. That's about the equivalent of getting people to walk to work in Tuktoyaktuk on December the 21st. It's a big challenge. And yet he was able to change the whole minds around entire cities and regions and how they worked. And that was where I got to see him first in action. Now, I've asked him a little bit about why his whole firm and he in particular take an entirely different approach than what most of us get a chance to work with when we're dealing with transportation planners. He said, he gave me the following quote. He said, you know, we recognize that transportation is not an end in itself, but a means by which communities achieve their larger economic, quality of life, social equity, and ecological goals. So they work with their clients to define their goals clearly, find ways to measure how those transportation investments that they're going to have to make, how can they also achieve these other goals. And so when you deal with Jeff and his team, you end up talking almost more about urban design and land use patterns than you do about transportation because of the whole interconnection of those. We can't simply solve congestion issues, mobility issues by adding more capacity. We actually have to take a look at the whole system that is fundamentally part of that. And so Jeff is going to take us further into this link between cities, movement, health, and spirituality in talking about some of the work and the ideas that he's been engaging in. Please welcome Jeff Tumlin.
Thank you, Mark. So I'm going to talk about a lot of problems, particularly health problems that are rooted in the decisions that we make in all of our cities about transportation, say a few words about how we got stuck in this predicament, and talk about the benefits of active transportation, and end with a few things that your cities can do. I have about 70 slides to cover in about 20 minutes, so we're going to move quickly. So sit back, relax, and put your thinking caps on. So why does active transportation matter? One of the things that I love about the health industry is they have really, really good data. And unlike my industry, they actually do follow-up studies to see how their predictive tools actually worked and then make adjustments accordingly. And so in the United States, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta has compiled trend data about a whole host of diseases, including obesity, and tracked that over time. So in 1986, we can look at the darker states that have significant rates of obesity, 1991, 1997, 2000, oh, we have to change the scale in 2004. 2005, we change the scale again. Time is speeding up. 2007, 2008, 2009. Obesity is a severe problem in the United States, and it is a problem that's rooted not just in diet, but even more so in activity, and that corresponds even more greatly with some of the diseases that are correlated with obesity and lack of activity, particularly diabetes, 1994, 2001, 2007. A third of adults in huge parts of my country diagnosed with obesity. Diabetes. Delightful disease that is causing increase in affliction is asthma. And one of the interesting studies back in 2000, during the Olympics in Atlanta, like in the 80 Olympics in Los Angeles, the transportation officials there said, oh my God, transportation chaos, it's going to be gridlock, it'll just be horrible, nobody drive. And so as a result, nobody drove, and in fact, the freeways were empty in Atlanta during the Olympics, and the health professionals there actually went to all the hospitals and collected data about who came to the hospital and under what conditions. They found a dramatic drop during that period of no driving in asthma, while at the same time, there was little, if any, drop in other reported conditions of the hospitals. So driving results in asthma, and it also results in a whole host of other conditions. And while the newspaper headlines get us all afraid of, shark attack and plane crash and, some mountain lion attack or something crazy going on in our community. In fact, for teenagers, the number one cause of death among teenagers in the United States is motor vehicle crashes. And fourth among all causes of death in the United States, and more importantly, a whole variety of related conditions, cancer, congenital anomalies, heart disease, are all related to transportation factors, particularly the lack of active transportation in our lives. The social sciences have also started to track data that relates to transportation. In fact, created a name for an entirely new condition called road rage, which there are endless scholarly articles that describe exactly the array, the soup of toxic chemicals that our own brains produce when dealing with the unique stresses associated with driving. These stresses and these health problems are worse if you happen to be young or old or brown or poor, and particularly if you're old. In fact, one of the greatest problems that most cities in North America are about to face in the coming decades is the number of people who are going to be over 65 and who are stranded in communities where walking cannot be a part of daily life. The science of gerontology teaches us that the minute we stop walking, we basically start dying. It's a huge problem. And I don't even need to get into the whole conversation about the relationship between our transportation decisions and global warming. In California, about 40% of our CO2 emissions are transport sector, and of that, 70% is us driving around. So what's at the root of all these problems? How could we have allowed the frog to be sitting in the pot of water while it's now at a full boil? Well, there's a simple answer, and it's this. Even though we know that sprawl equals death, that the fatality rate in our sprawling locations is 3, 5, in some cases 10 times greater, the traffic fatality rate, than it is in our more walkable urban centers, and that the lower density community we live in, the more driving that we do, the fatter that it makes us, the more unhealthy that it makes us.
Radio EcoShock will be right back in just a minute with more from Jeff Tumlin, the San Francisco planner who's telling us about the problems with cars.